Well, it is really good to see everybody here this morning. I want to echo once again the words that Dale had expressed earlier to our visitors. We're very encouraged by your presence. We would like you to know that you're welcome here, that the questions that you have about faith, about God and the Bible, are welcome here as well. That's one of the reasons why for the year of 2017 and probably beyond if it's a success, we've been asking for questions from our congregation. Questions about faith, questions about God, questions about the Bible, about how we're supposed to live in a fallen and broken world, the way that sin touches our lives. Any questions that you have are welcome. Sometimes people ask me if I get nervous when I preach, and I don't. Standing in front of you comes very naturally to me. I'm very comfortable up here. Until I have to do a request sermon. Then it becomes a little less comfortable because I figured a lot of the questions were going to be softballs. I mean, not that I doubt your intellect or anything like that. It doesn't have anything to do with that at all. But sometimes the questions that we have about the Bible are things that if we had just looked at them in a little different way, then they seem to click pretty quickly. But you have really, really knocked me down with the questions you've given me. And I'm very impressed with the questions. They are tough. They are doozies. But you asked, so we'll answer. So today's question, I think, is probably the toughest of all of them, because I figure if I get the toughest one out of the way first, the rest of them might not seem so terrifying to me. And you'll see in just a moment why it is such a difficult question, because it's a question that doesn't just touch our lives, but it's a question that touches our place and our role in society. Are we even relevant anymore on this topic? Somebody asked me then, is it possible anymore to be a relevant voice on the subject of sexual sins in our society? Now, the question was much longer than that. There was a lot more detail to it than that. So the person who asked this question, I'm not going to be able to touch on every aspect of the question that you asked, but I think we can get to the heart of the issue. In particular, what this person wanted to know was, how can we be relevant on the subject of homosexuality when it seems like what we would say on the subject is so out of touch and so out of place and so different from what our coworkers might say on the subject, or what friends and family might have to say on the subject, or what politicians and social commentators might have to say, or even what some professed believers might have to say on the subject who have tried to fashion themselves as welcoming in their churches to the LGBT community. So are we so hopelessly irrelevant on this subject then that we either look like dinosaurs at best, or we look like we're saying hate speech at worst? So let's jump right into the topic then, the challenge that we are facing. Because our culture's attitude and approach to not just homosexuality, but all forms of sexual sins has left us seeming pretty outdated on a lot of these things. And whether it is the prevalence of unmarried couples who live together, or the overwhelming acceptance of homosexuality in almost every quarter of our culture, or the rise of the post-gender society, where gender is not seen as binary, as in man and woman, but as sitting on a very fluid scale between those two things. We seem to be preaching, again, a message that is at best falling on deaf ears, or at worst, something that's going to get us thrown into prison one of these days. I say we, and of course I'm speaking in very general terms, not that you and I frequently speak in that kind of way. Our challenge, of course, is to ask the tough questions. To ask the tough questions and to have an answer when the world asks them. And I think it's very good, by the way, that we've asked tough questions. I don't want softballs. Perhaps softballs aren't the best way that we can use this half hour of our time every first or second Sunday of the month. We need to ask tough questions, and I admire it when you hand me a piece of notebook paper and say, here's one that I want you to think about, Ryan, and it's something that pushes me and challenges me, because the world, I guarantee you, the world is not going to be as friendly on this question. Like the little child, though, from the story of the emperor's new clothes, Sometimes we're called to be that lone voice that says what is obvious. Nobody else is willing to say it because nobody wants to hurt the emperor's feelings. And you remember the story, don't you? This emperor, an arrogant man who's very vain, cares only about his clothes and his looks, is duped by a couple of tricksters who convince him that they've made for him an outfit of such expensive and elaborate material that only the truly worthy can even see the material. So in his embarrassment at not being able to see the garment, the emperor goes along with the charade and pretends that he can see the fabric that is not, in fact, draped across his body. And everybody else in the kingdom plays along as well because they don't want to be the ones who look bad in front of the emperor. They don't want to be the ones who are seen as out of touch or out of step with what the emperor appears to believe. And yet, in the crowd of onlookers, of everybody who's oohing and aahing at the emperor's fancy new clothes, there's a little child who just speaks up and says, "Well, he's naked." And the child is the only one who's willing to admit what everybody actually can acknowledge, but chooses not to acknowledge. And that's an uncomfortable position for us to be in when we have a certain unpopular truth that we're called by God to represent. And I wonder, are we the only ones who are not talking about this subject? And when I say we, I do mean us specifically. Because when you look out at the world, it seems that everybody but us is willing to have this conversation and to be very vocal about it. Certainly on one side of the debate, you have those who wish to indulge in the flesh. You have those who are very much invested in the LGBT lifestyle, whether it's for themselves and the choices that they've made, or it's for family members, or it's simply for society in general, you have that side of the argument that is incredibly vocal. And then on the other side of it, you have this other group of people who will come out with nasty signs, and they'll throw things, and they'll yell, and they'll scream on a gay pride parade. I grew up in Portland, so you know that I saw this often. In fact, I would go to campus at Portland State University, and I would frequently see not only the lesbians on one side yelling and screaming for their rights, but on the other side, the street preachers with nasty signs, practically spitting their way through a sermon of hatred and vitriol. And there I was, standing in the middle. I don't belong on either side of that debate, do I? I certainly don't belong on the side of those who wish to indulge in the flesh. I'm supposed to be different than that. When I became a Christian, this is what it says in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 3. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh. And notice he says, and of the mind as well. That's a good point to make. It's not just desires of the flesh, but it's things that happen in here as well. The ideas that we hold to, whether it's self-perception or the perception of other people, ideas about identity, those things were a problem for us as well. And we too all formerly lived in those things. And we were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. And when I became a Christian, I left that behind. And I don't indulge in the flesh anymore. And I cannot support those who indulge in the flesh. So I can't be on that side of the debate. But do I belong on the side of those who would throw rocks onto sinners? Do I belong on the side of those who would pour nothing but hate out of their mouths and present the gospel message, a message that's supposed to be hope and good news, in a way that does nothing but shut the hearts and the minds of those to whom it's supposed to be presented and most useful? I can't do that either. I'm reminded of what it says in 2 Timothy chapter 2. As Paul writes to Timothy here, beginning in verse 24, "And the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, able to teach, and patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance, leading to the knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will." And I just don't think throwing stones on sinners fits the bill, the spirit of what Paul was writing to Timothy. If we are not able to correct with gentleness, if we are not able to approach sinners of the world with patience and with kindness and a message that is supposed to be one of hope, then I don't think we should be preaching at all. Because we're sending the wrong message about Jesus. And Christianity itself, for whatever reason, ends up looking like the bad guy and ends up looking like a very ugly thing in our society. And I don't think we're ugly. I don't think Monte Vista is ugly. I don't believe any one of you is ugly in the way that you present the gospel. But there are plenty of people out there who parade themselves as Christians who make Christianity look incredibly ugly to the people of the world. So why are we so out of touch, and is it hopeless? Well, partly it's because we've allowed other people to do the talking on this subject for us. Rather than engaging the people around us on our own, engaging coworkers, engaging people at school, engaging friends and family members who might themselves be transgender or homosexual, we have allowed the politicians and the social commentators and the street preachers to do all of the talking for us, and we are more than happy to let them do it. We are more than happy sometimes to simply let them represent us. And they don't always represent us very well. And they don't always represent Christ very well either. We can't keep silent on this subject, my friends. We can't sit on our hands and zip our mouths shut. We need to be the ones who start controlling the conversation when it comes to homosexuality. Or else we will never find a way to save anybody. So with that being said, Matthew chapter 10 and verse 16 actually requires us to act in a way that is shrewd but with kindness. Notice what it says here. Jesus speaking to his disciples in Matthew 10 verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. He knows that Jesus does understand and acknowledge that when we go out with an unpopular message, that we will be met with fierce resistance. So when you're met with fierce resistance today, Jesus completely understands exactly what you're going through. Sheep in the midst of wolves, he says, therefore be shrewd as servants, but to be as innocent as doves. And the thing I take away from that is to speak when something needs to be said. But to be so far above reproach in your character, to be so far above reproach in how you speak it and how you present it, that if somebody's going to have a problem with it, they have a problem with the message, not with you. Does that make sense? That if they're going to have a problem with it, they're going to have a problem with what you're saying, not how or why you're saying it. We will represent Christ no matter what. No matter what, we will represent Christ, and either we will represent him in a very bad way, and people will think of Christ the way that they think of us, in a bad way, or we'll represent him in a good way. And maybe they'll hate the message. Maybe they'll hate what we're saying. But they don't hate it because of us. They don't hate it because we presented it in the wrong way. We have to be above reproach in our character and in our attitudes and in our actions. We need to be consistent. We cannot be hypocrites in our own lives as far as the sin goes. And I love the way that Peter puts it in 1 Peter chapter 2. He says here in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, and we've reached that point, quite frankly. We've reached that point where if any Christian wants to say anything on the subject of LGBT issues, we are evildoers. We're the purveyors of hate speech simply because of what we want to present on the subject. We've reached that point. So that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. I'm also reminded in the book of Acts, and there are several different examples. Stephen was a man, when he was being put on trial, Stephen was a man who was so above reproach in his character that even when false witnesses came, well, they really couldn't figure out how to pin Stephen down on anything because the false witnesses were so outlandish. The Christians at one point, as they were growing in Jerusalem, as the church was growing and growing and growing, people all around them thought that they were strange. They thought that they were weird. They would not have anything to do with them in a social way. But they still regarded them with very high esteem. They respected them. Even though they didn't understand the gospel, even though they disagreed with the gospel, they nevertheless had a high esteem for the Christians in Jerusalem because of how they behaved. And that, my friends, is one of the greatest challenges that we must overcome on this subject. And real quickly, before we move on to another point here, don't act so surprised. All right, don't act so surprised if you happen to be one out of 20 co-workers who believes this. Don't act so surprised if what you say is unpopular, because truth is by its nature unpopular. Because think about what we're trying to present to the world. Think about what we are trying to present to the world. There are two choices, right? There's the narrow way, all right? And the narrow way is one of discipleship. And what does the word discipleship mean? But service. I mean, that's what a disciple is. It's someone who learns, someone who is being taught, someone who is serving. We are providing a narrow way. And it is a way of service. It's a way of effort and exertion. Where the world wants to offer a very broad way. The world wants to offer a way that says you can live however you want and do whatever you want. And it's okay, and nobody is allowed to tell you otherwise. And then the Christian has to chime in with Matthew 16 and say, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow Jesus. Does that sound like, of two choices, that would naturally be the most popular choice? If your choices are live for yourself and do whatever you want, or deny yourself and pick up a cross and follow Jesus, which one do you think is going to be the option that most people want to take in this world? So I just think sometimes we throw a pity party for ourselves because our message is so unpopular and so out of touch with the people around us. We shouldn't throw a pity party. This is what we should have expected from the very beginning of our discipleship. It's what we should have expected. And the first century Christians knew that as well. They came to expect that as well because their message was just as unpopular, if not more unpopular, than our message is today. So I guess the next question would be, what can we do? What are we supposed to do when we're asked this tough question by a coworker, by a friend, or a family member? And I'll give you a little bit of background, some context for why I find this such a challenging question to be asked, such a challenging thing to confront. Because in my own extended family, we have faced the issue. In my own extended family, we've had to ask very difficult questions. And I won't get very specific for you here. Not only just for your sakes, but out of respect for family members of mine who I care about and love, even though we're very different when it comes to this subject. I will say this, my mother's brother was a homosexual. My uncle, Uncle Mike, he was a homosexual who went off to Florida for college, and he found himself down there. In finding himself, though, he found himself eventually in San Francisco, and he found himself in the arms of somebody who brought about his ultimate destruction. And through the choices that he made and the lifestyle that he lived, he eventually died of AIDS. And if you want to leave an impression on an 11-year-old boy, if you really want to leave an impression on an 11-year-old boy, have him have a conversation, a last conversation with his uncle dying of AIDS. And I'll never forget what that looked like. And I have family members now to this day, one of whom is transgender. And it has rocked our family. It has rocked our family to the point where some family members won't talk to each other anymore over this issue. So I don't speak from a point of inexperience when I ask the question, what are we supposed to do about this? What can we do? Well, the first thing I would say is this. Try to have an open mind. Oh, I know. Have an open mind? Isn't that what liberals do? Right? Have an open mind. Have an open mind about the physical, mental, and emotional burdens that some people face that you might never fully understand. Because if you're not a homosexual, then you don't understand what it's like to be a homosexual. You don't understand that. And I don't understand that. So rather than being crass, rather than being crude, rather than being so bold about this that we might say something that's insensitive or out of place, we need to at least keep an open mind. And not approval, that's not what I'm saying. But to keep an open mind about the burden that people bear when they're facing this sin in their lives. To keep an open mind about how challenging it would be to face this temptation every single day of your life. And to hear the message, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow after me. And put yourself in their shoes and imagine what it would be like if some part of you, you had to deny every day until you were dead. And I think that's just a burden that we don't always understand. Now, even though I think biologically speaking, sex is binary by design, that there are men and there are women, and that is the rule. What I mean by rule is you have exceptions, perhaps, in some cases, and you have a rule, the exception does not make the rule. By design, we are men and we are women. However, this doesn't mean that every single person who's born fits comfortably or conveniently into one gender or the other. Now, please understand, I'm not speaking with approval on the choices that some people make, the lifestyle that they live, or the sins that they commit. I'm simply saying, put yourself in somebody else's shoes and understand that not everybody feels comfortable in one or the other of man or woman. And again, that's simply a burden that they have to bear. God made us male and female, to be sure. He made them male and female from the beginning, but we're all subject to the curse of Genesis chapter 3. And what I mean by that curse is that our bodies break. Our bodies can even be born broken. And in the same way that somebody might be born with a disability or a disfigurement of some kind in their physical person, who's to say that somebody might not also be born with a brain? Or hormones, or reproductive organs that are also malfunctioning in some way. Now, I know that God made us to be beautiful, and God made us to be wonderful, and the psalmist even says, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. But again, that's the rule. The exception does not make the rule, and there are exceptions. And in the same way that somebody might be born blind, again, that's the exception, not the rule. We, as human beings, are fearfully and wonderfully made. We, as human beings, are designed by God to be man and woman, but we're also designed to be seeing. We're designed to be walking. We're designed to have digestive systems and lungs that are fully functioning. And some people are born in a way that does not fit the design. That is a product of the curse. That is a product of a world that is filled with sin, where bodies can be broken, where bodies can be hurt, where there is incredible emotional and spiritual and mental and physical suffering. Remember, even Jesus acknowledged that some people are born that way on the subject of eunuchs when he mentions in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 12 when the disciples ask about marriage and divorce, and if the marriage is supposed to be like that, then who can bear it? And Jesus said, only those to whom it has been given. And he goes on to explain that some people choose to become eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of God. And some people are made eunuchs by other men, as in they are castrated by a lord and put into service in his harem or in his kingdom in some way. And Jesus says in his own words, and some men are born as eunuchs.
And I believe what Jesus is saying is exactly what we've been saying for the last 5 minutes. That as a product of the curse of a fallen world where things break, that some people are born with reproductive organs or hormones that do not function as God's design would have them. Some people are born that way. Along the same lines, eunuchs were excluded from entrance into the tabernacle, according to Deuteronomy 23, verse 1, even though they were capable of displaying incredible devotion and faith, as Isaiah 56, verses 1 through 5 would say, which I believe is also a prophecy that a time would come when even the eunuch would be welcomed into the kingdom, into the great assembly. And you have that played out, just as we studied very recently in our classes, in the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8. Now, what I'm saying, the only point that I want to make, is to not show any approval for sin that is committed, but to simply show that God acknowledges over and over and over again that there are physical and emotional and mental burdens that people bear that make it, again, either uncomfortable or inconvenient for them to fit comfortably into one category and the other. Remember what a eunuch is in the ancient world, in the first century in particular, the eunuch fit a social class that was neither male nor female. People around them did not consider them to be fully male or to have transitioned into female. They held a social class that was all their own. That's the reality of it. And the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8 was not condemned for simply being a eunuch. Simply being something in a physical sense does not condemn a person. Here's the real crux of it. It's how we act upon it that makes the difference. Simply being something does not make one a sinner. But acting upon our impulses is what makes us sinners. And I believe 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9, 10, and 11 play that out. That there were some in Corinth, as the apostle would put it, who were homosexual. Such were some of you, he says in the past tense in verse 11. Now, does that mean that someone who was a homosexual suddenly stops being a homosexual in some physical or hormonal sense? Or that once they're baptized, they stop desiring homosexual activity? Of course not. And that's a burden that the homosexual might have to bear for the rest of his life. But what they stop doing is acting upon that. And these are truths that cannot be compromised by the Christian. Because God has plainly and consistently condemned homosexuality in every covenantal age, whether it be in the time of the patriarchs or under the law of Moses, or in the Christian age in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, or in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, or in even Matthew chapter 19, where Jesus clearly says that marriage is for one man and one woman for life. And if one cannot accept these terms, if one cannot accept the terms of sexual union and marriage, then one should not partake of sexual union and marriage. And one is not allowed by God to partake in sexual union and in marriage. So is it possible, and here's our last point before we'll stop for the morning, is it possible to get along with others in a world that has almost universally rejected this divine standard? A couple of practical applications as we bring our lesson to a close. You don't have to understand everything about a person's situation to be kind, thoughtful, and willing to study with him or her. I don't have to understand what it is like to be transgender, to have that impulse. I don't have to understand what it is like to have homosexual desire coursing through my emotions and my body. I don't have to understand it to be kind to people. And to be sincere. And to be compassionate. Jesus himself never understood what it was like to commit adultery. And yet when that woman in the Gospel of John was faced with stoning for being caught in the very act of adultery, even though Jesus could not personally understand from personal experience what it was like to commit adultery and to be caught in the very act, he was able to approach this woman with nothing but kindness and compassion and sincerity while also presenting a hard truth to her. focus on helping people change their behavior, not their biology. I think we've made the mistake, again, we, in the general sense, we have made the mistake of burying our heads in the sand, so to speak, when it comes to the biological reality of the sins that people are facing and the temptations that they have to live with every single day. What I mean by that is simply telling someone to stop being gay is not ever going to help someone stop being gay. And all it does is, I think, close us off from the opportunity to actually help people change their behavior, to change how they act on their impulses. And perhaps over time the impulses might change, the desire itself might change or subside in some way. But when we're talking to unbelievers who face this sin, we can't just tell them to stop being gay. We have to help them see that it is behavior. It is action that God wants to see. And at some point in their lives, when action and behavior and choice, when those things have been molded in God's image, attitude tends to follow. And desire tends to follow as well. When we set our feet to follow God, when we make the choice to live for God, when we make the choice that no matter what my heart says to do, no matter what my body says to do, no matter what my emotions say to do, my soul says follow God no matter what. Maybe the desire never changes. And that's the burden we have to live with for the rest of our lives. But maybe at some point it does. And you'll never find out until you take the first step of obedience to following God, to conform your life and your actions to God's will, I think is the best first step. And let others come to you with their questions. I think the street preachers have made it very clear that an aggressive, judgmental approach to the subject of LGBT issues is not a very effective means of converting anybody to Jesus Christ. I think our best approach is to simply be the best Christians that we can be, to let our lights shine before others in such a way that they may see God in our actions and glorify God. They will come to us when they see that we're different. They will come to us when they see that we are not a threat to them, but that we are their best hope of salvation. Rather than being a source of incredible pain to them, the Christian can become a balm to them. When life and their friends and people of the world take advantage of them, when their bodies are destroyed by sexually transmitted diseases, when they face nothing but hopelessness in a world that tells them to just indulge in the flesh with hopeless and reckless abandon, maybe, just maybe, a consistent, kind, truth-filled voice will be the one thing that brings them back from the brink of total spiritual destruction. And we need to be there for them. We need to be there for them when their lives fall apart. My Uncle Mike came back from San Francisco as a 40-year-old man, penniless, dying of AIDS. And he knocked on my grandparents' front door and said, "I have nothing. Can I come home?" And my grandparents let him come home. And he spent the last couple years of his life traveling to churches and Christian colleges, using himself as the ultimate example of what your choices do to you when they're the wrong choices. And that was a man who redeemed himself in people's eyes and in God's eyes as well. And when sinners of the world come back, when they want to know who God is, let's show them who God is. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. You have an opportunity right now to make things right with God. If you're not a Christian, then heed the message of the gospel, which in such simple, beautiful terms says, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved."
Mark 16, verse 16. So if you have any spiritual need at all, I encourage you to please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.